Pop Goes the Weasel by James Patterson. Copyright 1999 by James Patterson. This recording of the full-length reading of Pop Goes the Weasel was published by arrangement with Time Warner Audiobook and was produced in 1999 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. This book is read by Michael Kramer. Pop Goes the Weasel by James Patterson. This book consists of 5 books in 124 chapters and is 423 pages long. The following material appears in the dust jacket of the book. Alex Cross is back. Cross will face his most complex and formidable villain yet. Pop Goes the Weasel is Alex Cross and James Patterson at their best. With more than 750,000 copies in print, When the Wind Blows took Patterson to a whole new level. Now, with Pop Goes the Weasel, he and Alex Cross are on their way even higher. Pop Goes the Weasel is James Patterson at the peak of his power. It's his most dynamic and powerful psychological thriller to date. Here is a villain no reader will forget, a love story of great tenderness, and a plot of relentless suspense and heart-pounding pace. About the author. James Patterson is the best-selling author of 5 major national bestsellers in a row. These include Along Came a Spider, Kiss the Girls, Jack and Jill, Cat and Mouse, and most recently, When the Wind Blows. A past winner of the prestigious Edgar Award, Patterson lives in New York and Florida. Dedication. This is for Susie and Jack, and for the millions of Alex Cross readers who so frequently ask, "Can't you write faster?" Prologue. 1. Jeffrey Schaefer, dashingly outfitted in a single-breasted blue blazer, white shirt, striped tie, and narrow gray trousers from H. Huntsman & Sons, walked out of his townhouse at 7:30 in the morning and climbed into a black Jaguar XJ12. He backed the Jag slowly out of the driveway, then stepped on the accelerator. The sleek sports car rocketed up to 50 before it reached the stop sign at Connecticut Avenue in the posh Kalorama section of Washington, D.C. When Schaefer reached the busy intersection, he didn't stop. He floored the accelerator, picking up more speed. He was doing 65 and ached to crash the Jag into the stately fieldstone wall bordering the avenue. He aimed the Jag closer to the wall. He could see the head-on collision, visualize it, feel it all over. At the last possible second, he tried to avoid the deadly crash. He spun the wheel hard to the left. The sports car fishtailed all the way across the avenue, tires screeching and burning, the smell of rubber thick in the air. The Jag skidded to a stop, headed the wrong way on the street, the windshield issuing its glossy black stare at a barrage of early oncoming traffic. Schaefer stepped on the accelerator again and headed forward against the oncoming traffic. Every car and truck began to honk loud, sustained blasts. Schaefer didn't even try to catch his breath or bearings. He sped along the avenue, gaining speed. He zoomed across Rock Creek Bridge and made a left, then another left onto Rock Creek Parkway. A tiny scream of pain escaped from his lips. It was involuntary, coming swiftly and unexpectedly. A moment of fear, weakness. He floored the gas pedal again, and the engine roared. He was doing 70, then pressing to 80. He zigged and zagged around slower-moving sedans, sport utility vehicles, a soot-covered A&P delivery truck. Only a few honked now. Other drivers in the parkway were terrified, scared out of their minds. He exited the Rock Creek Parkway at 50 miles an hour, then he gunned it again. P Street was even more crowded at that hour than the parkway had been. Washington was just waking up and setting off to work. He could still see that inviting stone wall in Connecticut. He shouldn't have stopped. He began searching for another rock-solid object, looking for something to hit very hard. He was doing 80 miles an hour as he approached DuPont Circle. He shot forward like a ground rocket. 2 lines of traffic were backed up at a red light. No way out of this one, he thought. Nowhere to go left or right. He didn't want to rear-end a dozen cars. That was no way to end this. End his life by smashing into a commonplace Chevy Caprice, a Honda Accord, a delivery truck. He swerved violently to the left and veered into the lanes of traffic coming east, coming right at him. He could see the panicked, disbelieving faces behind the dusty, grime-smeared windshields. The horns started to blast, a high-pitched symphony of fear. He ran the next light and just barely squeezed between an oncoming Jeep and a concrete mixer truck. He sped down M Street, then onto Pennsylvania Avenue, and headed toward Washington Circle. The George Washington University Medical Center was up ahead. A perfect ending? The Metro Patrol car appeared out of nowhere, its siren bullhorn screaming in protest, its rotating beacon glittering, signaling for him to pull over. Schaefer slowed down and pulled to the curb. The cop hurried to Schaefer's car, his hand on his holster. He looked frightened and unsure.
"Get out of the car, sir," the cop said in a commanding voice. "Get out of the car right now."
Schaefer suddenly felt calm and relaxed. There was no tension left in his body.
All right, I'm getting out. No problem."
"You know how fast you were going?"
the cop asked in an agitated voice, his face flushed a bright red. Schaefer noticed that the cop's hand was still on his gun. Schaefer pursed his lips, thought about his answer.
"Well, I'd say about 30, officer," he finally said. "Maybe a little over the speed limit."
Then he took out an ID card and handed it over.
"But you can't do anything about it. I'm with the British Embassy. I have diplomatic immunity."
2. That night, as he was driving home from work, Jeffrey Schaefer started to feel that he was losing control again. He was beginning to frighten himself. His whole life had begun to revolve around a fantasy game he played called The Four Horsemen. In the game, he was the player called Death. The game was everything to him, the only part of his life with real meaning. He sped across town from the British Embassy, all the way to the Petworth District of Northwest. He knew he shouldn't be there, a white man in a spiffy Jaguar. He couldn't help himself, though, any more than he could that morning. He stopped the car just before he got to Petworth. Schaefer took out his laptop and typed a message to the other players, the horsemen. "Friends, Death is on the loose in Washington. The game is on." He started the jag again and rode a few more blocks to Petworth. The usual outrageously provocative hookers were already parading up and down Varnum and Webster streets. A song named Nice and Slow was playing from a vibrating blue BMW. Ronnie McCall's sweet voice blended into the early evening. The girls waved to him and showed their large, flat, pert, or flappy breasts. Several wore colorful bustiers with matching hot pants and shiny silver or red platform shoes with pointy heels. He slowed to a stop beside a small black girl who looked to be around 16 and had an unusually pretty face. Her legs were long and slender for such a petite body. She wore too much makeup for his taste. Still, she was hard to resist, so why should he?
"Nice car, Jaguar.
I like it a lot," she cooed,
then smiled and made a sexy little O with her lipsticked mouth.
"You're cute too, mister."
He smiled back at her.
"Jump in, then. Let's go for a test ride. See if it's true love or just infatuation."
He glanced around the street quickly. None of the other girls were working this corner.
"A hundred for full service, sweetie?"
she asked as she wiggled her tight little butt inside the jag. Her perfume smelled like eau de bubble gum, and she seemed to have bathed in it.
"As I said, get into the car. $100 is petty cash for me."
He knew he shouldn't be picking her up in the Jaguar, but he took her for a joyride anyway. He couldn't help himself now. He brought the girl to a small wooded park in a part of Washington called Shaw. He parked in a thicket of fir trees that hid the car from sight. He looked at the prostitute, and she was even smaller and younger than he had thought.
"How old are you?"
he asked.
"How old do you want me to be?"
she said, and smiled.
"Sweetie, I need the money first. You know how it works."
"Yes.
But do you?"
he asked. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a switchblade knife. He had it at her throat in an instant.
"Don't hurt me," she whispered. "Just be cool."
"Get out of the car. Slowly. Don't you dare scream. You be cool." Schaefer got out with her, staying close, the knife still pressed to the hollow of her throat.
"It's all just a game, darling," he explained. "My name is Death. You're a very lucky girl. I'm the best player of all."
As if to prove it, he stabbed her for the first time. Book 1. The Jane Doe Murders. Chapter 1. Things were going pretty well that day. I was driving a bright orange school bus through Southeast on a blistering hot morning in late July, and I was whistling a little Al Green as I drove. I was in the process of picking up 16 boys from their houses and also 2 foster homes. Door-to-door bus service. Hard to beat. Just 1 week earlier, I had returned from Boston and the Mr. Smith murder case. Mr. Smith and a deranged killer named Gary Sonagy had both been involved in that one. I needed to rest, and I'd taken the morning off to do something I'd been looking forward to for a change. My partner, John Sampson, and a 12-year-old named Errol Mignol sat behind me on the bus. John was wearing Wayfarer shades, black jeans, and a black T-shirt that read, "Alliance of Concerned Men. Send donations today." He is 6'9", a very solid 250 pounds. We've been friends since we were 10, when I first moved to D.C. He, Errol, and I were talking about the boxer Sugar Ray Robinson, almost shouting over the bus's blustery, occasionally misfiring engine. Sampson had his huge arm lightly draped over Errol's shoulders. Proper physical contact is encouraged when dealing with these boys. Finally, we picked up the last little guy in our list, an 8-year-old who lived in Benning Terrace, a tough project known to some of us as Simple City. As we left the project, an ugly smear of graffiti told visitors everything they needed to know about the neighborhood. It read, "You are now leaving the war zone, and you live to tell about it." We were taking the boys out to Lorton Prison in Virginia. They would be visiting their fathers for the afternoon. They were all young, between 8 and 13. The Alliance transports 40 to 50 kids each week to see their fathers and mothers in different prisons. The goal is a lofty one, to bring the crime rate in Washington down by a third. I'd been out to the prison more times than I cared to remember. I knew the warden at Lorton pretty well. A few years back, I'd spent a lifetime there, interviewing Gary Sonagy. Warden Marion Campbell had set up a large room on Level 1 where the boys met with their fathers. It was a powerful scene, even more emotional than I'd expected. The Alliance spends time training the fathers who want to participate in the program. There are 4 steps: how to show love, accept fault and responsibility, attain parent and child harmony, discover new beginnings. Ironically, the boys are all trying to look and act tougher than they actually were. I heard one boy say, "You weren't in my life before, why should I listen to you now?" But the fathers were trying to show a softer side. Sampson and I hadn't made the run to Lorton before. It was our first time. But I was already sure I'd do it again. There was so much raw emotion and hope in the room, so much potential for something good and decent. Even if some of it would never be realized, it showed that an effort was being made, and something positive could come from it. What struck me most was the bond that still existed between some of the fathers and their young sons. I thought about my own boy Damon and how lucky we were. The thing about most of the prisoners in Lorton was that they knew what they had done was wrong. They just didn't know how to stop doing it. For most of the hour and a half, I just walked around and listened. I was occasionally needed as a psychologist, and I did the best I could on short notice. At one little group, I heard a father say, "Please tell your mother I love her, and I miss her like crazy." Then both the prisoner and his son broke into tears and hugged each other fiercely. Sampson came up to me after we'd been in the prison for an hour or so. He was grinning broadly. His smile, when it comes, is a killer. "Man, I love this. Do-gooder shit is the best."
Yeah, I'm hooked myself. I'll drive the big orange bus again. Think it'll help? Fathers and sons meeting like this? He asked me. I looked around the room. I think today, right now, this is a success for these men and their sons. That's good enough. Samson nodded. The old one-day-at-a-time approach. Works for me, too. I am flying, Alex. So was I. So was I. I'm a sucker for this kind of stuff. As I drove the young boys home that afternoon, I could see by their faces that they'd had positive experiences with their fathers. The boys weren't nearly as noisy and rambunctious on the way back to D.C. They weren't trying to be so tough. They were just acting like kids. Almost every one of the boys thanked Samson and me as he got off the big orange bus. It wasn't necessary. It sure was a lot better than chasing after homicidal maniacs. The last boy we dropped off was the 8-year-old from Benning Terrace. He hugged both John and me, and then he started to cry.
I missed my dad,
he said, before running home. Chapter 2 That night, Samson and I were on duty in Southeast. We're senior homicide detectives, and I'm also liaison between the FBI and the D.C. police. We got a call at about 12:30 telling us to go to the area of Washington called Shaw. There'd been a bad homicide. A lone Metro squad car was at the murder scene, and the neighborhood psychos had turned out in pretty fair numbers. It looked like a bizarre block party in the middle of hell. Fires were blazing nearby, throwing off sparks in 2 trash barrels, which made no sense given the sweltering heat of the night. The victim was a young woman, probably between 14 and her late teens, according to the radio report. She wasn't hard to find. Her nude, mutilated body had been discarded in a clump of briar bushes in a small park less than 10 yards off a paved pathway. As Samson and I approached the body, a boy shouted at us from the other side of the crime tape.
Yo, yo, she just some street whore.
I stopped and looked at him. He reminded me of the boys we'd just transported to Lorton Prison.
Dime a dozen, bitch. Ain't worth your time or mine, defectives,
he went on with his disturbing rap. I walked up to the young wisecracker. How do you know that? You seen her around? The boy backed off, but then he grinned, showing off a gold star on one of his front teeth.
She ain't got no clothes on, and she laying on her back. Somebody stick her good. Sure sound like a whore to me.
Samson eyed the youth, who looked to be around 14, but might have been even younger. You know who she is?
Hell no.
The boy pretended to be insulted.
Don't know no whores, man.
The boy finally swaggered off, looking back at us once or twice and shaking his head. Samson and I walked on and joined 2 uniformed cops standing by the body. They were obviously waiting for reinforcements. Apparently, we were it. You call emergency services? I asked the uniforms. 35 minutes ago and counting, said the older-looking of the two. He was probably in his late 20s, sporting an attempted mustache and trying to look as if he were experienced at scenes like this one. That figures. I shook my head. You find any ID anywhere around here?
No ID. We looked around in the bushes. Nothing but the body, said the younger one. And the body's seen better days.
He was perspiring badly and looked a little sick. I put on latex gloves and bent down over the corpse. She did appear to be in her mid to late teens. The girl's throat had been slit from ear to ear. Her face was badly slashed. So were the soles of her feet, which seemed odd. She'd been stabbed a dozen or more times in her chest and stomach. I pushed open her legs. I saw something that made me sick. A metal handle was barely visible between her legs. I was almost sure it was a knife, and that it had been driven all the way into her vagina. Samson crouched and looked at me. What are you thinking, Alex? Another one? I shook my head, shrugged my shoulders. Maybe. But she's an addict, John. Tracks on her arms and legs. Probably behind her knees, under her arms. Our boy doesn't usually go after addicts. He practices safe sex. The murder's brutal, though. That fits the style. You see the metal handle? Samson nodded. He didn't miss much. Clothes, he said. Where the hell did they go to? We need to find the clothes. Somebody in the neighborhood probably stripped them off her already, said the young uniform. There was a lot of disturbance around the body. Several footprints in the dirt. That's how it goes around here. Nobody seems to care. We're here, I said to him. We care. We're here for all the Jane Does.
Chapter 3 Jeffrey Schaefer was so happy he almost couldn't hide it from his family. He had to keep from laughing out loud as he kissed his wife Lucy on the cheek. He caught a whiff of her Chanel No. 5 perfume, then tasted the brittle dryness of her lips as he kissed her again. They were standing around like statues in the elegant galley hall of the large Georgian house in Kalorama. The children had been summoned to say goodbye to him. His wife, the former Lucy Reese Cousins, was ash blonde, her sparkling green eyes even brighter than the Bulgari and spark jewelry that she always wore. Slender, still a beauty of sorts at 37, Lucy had attended Newnham College at Cambridge for 2 years before they were married. She read useless poetry and literary novels and spent most of her free time at equally pointless lunches, shopping with her expatriate girlfriends, going to polo matches, or sailing. Occasionally, Schaefer sailed with her. He'd been a very good sailor once upon a time. Lucy had been considered a prize catch, and he supposed that she still would be, for some men. Well, they could have her skinny, bony ass and all the passionless sex they could stomach. Schaefer hoisted up 4-year-old twins Tricia and Erica, one in each arm. 2 mirror images of their mother. He'd have sold the twins for the price of a postage stamp. He hugged the girls and laughed like the good papa he always pretended to be. Then he formally shook 12-year-old Robert's hand. The debate being waged in the house was over whether Robert should be sent back to England for boarding school, perhaps to Winchester, where his grandfather had gone. Schaefer gave his son a crisp military salute. Once upon a time, Colonel Jeffrey Schaefer had been a soldier. Only Robert seemed to remember that part of his father's life now. I'm only going away to London for a few days, and this is work, not a holiday. I'm not planning to spend my nights at the Athenaeum or anything like that, he told his family. He was smiling jovially, the way they expected him to be. Try to have some fun while you're away, Dad. Have some laughs. God knows you deserve it, Robert said, talking in the lower-octave man-to-man's voice that he seemed to be adopting lately. Bye, Daddy! Bye, Daddy! The twins chorused shrilly, making Schaefer want to throw them against the walls. Bye, Erica-san. Bye, Tricia-san. Remember Orc's Nest, Robert said with sudden urgency. Dragon and the Duelist. Orc's Nest was a store that sold role-playing books and gaming equipment. It was located on Earlham, just off Cambridge Circus in London. Dragon and the Duelist were currently the 2 hot-shit British magazines covering role-playing games. Unfortunately for Robert, Schaefer wasn't actually going to London. He had a much better plan for the weekend. He was going to play his fantasy game right here in Washington. Chapter 4 He sped due east, rather than toward Washington's Dulles Airport, feeling as if a tremendously burdensome weight had been lifted. God, he hated his perfect English family, and even more their claustrophobic life here in America. Schaefer's own family back in England had been perfect as well. He had 2 older brothers, and they'd both been excellent students, model youths. His father had been a military attaché, and the family had traveled around the globe until he was 12, when they'd returned to England, and settled into Guildford, about 30 minutes outside London. Once there, Schaefer began to expand on the schoolboy mischief he'd practiced since he was 8. The center of Guildford contained several historic buildings, and he set out to gleefully deface all of them. He began with the Abbott's Hospital, where his grandmother was dying. He painted obscenities on the walls. Then he moved on to Guildford Castle, Guildhall, the Royal Grammar School, and Guildford Cathedral. He scrawled more obscene words and splashed large penises in bright colors. He had no idea why he took such joy in ruining beautiful things, but he did. He loved it. And he especially loved not getting caught. Schaefer was eventually sent to school at Rugby, where the pranks continued. Then he attended St. John's College, where he concentrated on philosophy, Japanese, and shagging as many good-looking women as he possibly could. All his friends were mystified when he went into the army at 21. His language skills were excellent, and he was posted to Asia, which was where the mischief rose to a new level, and where he began to play the game of games. He stopped at a 7-Eleven in Washington Heights for coffee. Three coffees, actually. Black, with four sugars in each. He drank most of one of the cups on his way to the counter. The Indian cashier gave him a cheeky, suspicious look, and he laughed in the bearded wanker's face. "Do you really think I'd steal a bloody 75-cent cup of coffee, you pathetic jerk-off, you pitiful wog?" He threw his money on the counter and left before he killed the clerk with his bare hands, which he could do easily enough. From the 7-Eleven, he drove into the northeast part of Washington, a middle-class section called Eckington. He began to recognize the streets when he was west of Gallaudet University. Most of the structures were two-storied apartments with vinyl siding, either red brick or a hideous Easter egg blue that always made him wince. He stopped in front of one of the red-brick garden apartments on Euland Terrace near 2nd Street. This one had an attached garage. A previous tenant had adorned the brick facade with two white concrete cats. "Hello, pussies," Schaefer said. He felt relieved to be here. He was cycling up, that is, getting high, manic. He loved this feeling, couldn't get enough of it. It was time to play the game. Chapter 5. A rusted and taped-up purple-and-blue taxi was parked inside the two-car garage. Schaefer had been using it for about 4 months. The taxi gave him anonymity, made him almost invisible anywhere he chose to go in D.C. He called it his nightmare machine. He wedged the Jaguar beside the taxicab, then he jogged upstairs. Once inside the apartment, he switched on the air conditioning. He drank another sugar-laced coffee. Then he took his pills like a good boy. Thorazine and Librium, Benadryl, Xanax, and Vicodin. He'd been using the drugs in various combinations for years. It was mostly a trial-and-error process, but he'd learned his lessons well. "Feeling better, Jeffrey?" "Yes, much better, thank you." He tried to read today's Washington Post, then an old copy of Private Eye magazine, and finally a catalog from Damask, a rubber and leather fetish wholesaler in Amsterdam, the world's largest. He did 200 push-ups, then a few hundred sit-ups, impatiently waiting for darkness to fall over Washington. At 9:45, Schaefer began to get ready for a big night on the town. He went into the small, barren bathroom, which smelled of cheap cleanser. He stood before the mirror. He liked what he saw, very much so. Thick and wavy blonde hair that he would never lose, a charismatic electric smile, startling blue eyes that had a cinematic quality, excellent physical shape for a man of 44. He went to work, starting with brown contact lenses. He'd done this so many times he could almost do it blindfolded. It was a part of his trade craft. He applied blackface to his face, neck, hands, wrists, thick padding to make his neck seem broader than it was, a dark watch cap to cover every last strand of hair. He stared hard at himself and saw a rather convincing-looking black man, especially if the light wasn't too strong. Not bad. Not bad at all. It was a good disguise for a night on the town, especially if the town was Washington. So let the games begin. The Four Horsemen. At 10:25, he went down to the garage again. He carefully circled around the Jaguar and walked to the purple and blue taxi cab. He had already begun to lose himself in delicious fantasy. Schaefer reached into his pants pocket and pulled out three unusual-looking dice. They were 20-sided, the kind used in most fantasy games or RPGs. They had numerals on them rather than dots. He held the dice in his left hand, rolling them over and over. There were explicit rules to the Four Horsemen. Everything was supposed to depend on the dice roll. The idea was to come up with an outrageous fantasy, a mind-blower. The four players around the world were competing. There had never been a game like this. Nothing even came close. Schaefer had already prepared an adventure for himself, but there were alternatives for every event. Much depended on the dice. That was the main point. Anything could happen. He got into the taxi, started it up. Good Lord, was he ready for this. Chapter 6. He had a gorgeous plan mapped out. He would pick up only those few passengers, fares, who caught his eye, fired up his imagination to the limit. He wasn't in a hurry. He had all night. He had all weekend. He was on a busman's holiday. His route had been laid out beforehand. First he drove to the fashionable Adams Morgan neighborhood. He watched the busy sidewalks, which seemed one long syncopated rhythm of movement, bar grazers slouching toward hipness. It seemed that every other restaurant in Adams Morgan called itself a café. Driving slowly and checking the glittery sights, he passed Café Picasso, Café Lautrec, La Fourchette Café, Bucom Café, Café Dalol, Montego Café, Sheba Café. Around 11:30 on Columbia Road, he slowed the taxi cab. His heart began to thump. Something very good was shaping up ahead. A handsome-looking couple were leaving the popular Chief Ike's Mambo Room. A man and a woman, Hispanic, probably in their late 20s. Sensual beyond belief. He rolled the dice across the front seat. 6-5-4. A total of 15. A high count. Danger. That made sense. A couple was always tricky and risky. Schaefer waited for them to cross the pavement, moving away from the restaurant canopy. They came right toward him. How accommodating. He touched the handle of the Magnum that he kept under the front seat. He was ready for anything. As they started to climb into the taxi, he changed his mind. He could do that. Schaefer saw that neither of them was as attractive as he'd thought. The man's cheeks and forehead were slightly mottled. The pomade in his black hair was too thick and greasy. The woman was a few pounds heavier than he liked, plumper than she'd looked from a distance in the flattering streetlights. "Off duty," he said, and sped away. Both of them gave him the finger. Schaefer laughed out loud.
"You're in luck tonight. Fools, luckiest night of your lives, and you don't even know it."
The incomparable thrill of the fantasy had completely taken hold of him. He'd had total power over the couple. He had control of life and death. "Death, be proud," he whispered. He stopped for more coffee at a Starbucks on Rhode Island Avenue. Nothing like it. He purchased 3 black coffees and heaped 6 sugars in each. An hour later, he was in Southeast. He hadn't stopped for another fare. The streets were crowded to the max with pedestrians. There weren't enough taxis, not even gypsies in this part of Washington. He regretted having let the Hispanic couple get away. He'd begun to romanticize them in his mind, to visualize them as they'd looked in the streetlight. Remembrance of things past, right? He thought of Proust's monumental opening line, "For a long time I used to go to bed early." And so had Schaefer, until he discovered the game of games. Then he saw her, a perfect brown goddess standing right there before him, as if someone had just given him a wonderful present. She was walking by herself about a block from E Street, moving fast, purposefully. He was instantly high again. He loved the way she moved, the swivel of her long legs, the exactness of her carriage. As he came up behind her, she began looking around, checking the street. Looking for a taxi? Could it be? Did she want him? She had on a light cream suit, a purple silk shirt, high heels. She looked too classy and adult to be going to a club. She appeared to be in control of herself. He quickly rolled the 20-sided dice again and held his breath, counted the numerals. His heart leaped. This was what the horseman was all about. She was waving her hand at him, signaling.
"Taxi!" she called. "Taxi! Are you free?"
He guided the taxi over to the curb, and she took three quick, delicate steps toward him. She was wearing shimmery, silken high heels that were just delightful. She was much prettier up close. She was a 9.5 out of 10. The cab door swung open and blocked his view of her for a second. Then he saw that she was carrying flowers and wondered why. Something special tonight? Well, that was certainly true. The flowers were for her own funeral.
"Oh, thank you so much for stopping."
She spoke breathlessly as she settled into the taxi. He could tell that she was letting herself relax and feel safe. Her voice was soothing, sweet, down to earth and real.
"At your service."
Schaefer turned and smiled at her.
"By the way, on death, you're my fantasy for this weekend."
Chapter 7
Monday mornings I usually work the soup kitchen at St. Anthony's in Southeast, where I've been a volunteer for the past half dozen years. I do the 7-to-9 shift 3 days a week. That morning I felt restless and uneasy. I was still getting over the Mr. Smith case, which had taken me all over the East Coast and to Europe. Maybe I needed a real vacation, a holiday far away from Washington. I watched the usual lineup of men, women, and children who had no money for food. It was about 5 deep and went up 12th Street to the second corner. It seemed such a pity, so unfair that so many folks still go hungry in Washington or get fed only once a day. I had started helping out at the kitchen years before on account of my wife, Maria. She was doing casework as a social worker at St. Anthony's when we first met. Maria was the uncrowned princess of St. Anthony's. Everybody loved her, and she loved me. She had been shot, murdered in a drive-by incident not far from the soup kitchen. We'd been married 4 years and had 2 small children. The case has never been solved, and that still tortures me. Maybe that's what drives me to solve every case I can, no matter how bad the odds. At St. Anthony's Soup Kitchen, I help make sure nobody gets too riled up or causes undue trouble during meals. I'm 6'3", about 200 pounds, and built for peacekeeping, if and when it's necessary. I can usually ward off trouble with a few quiet words and non-threatening gestures. Most of these people are here to eat, though, not fight or cause trouble. I also dish out peanut butter and jelly to anyone who wants seconds or even thirds of the stuff. Jimmy Moore, the Irish-American who runs the soup kitchen with much love and just the right amount of discipline, has always believed in the healing power of PB&J. Some of the regulars at the kitchen call me Peanut Butter Man. They've been doing it for years.
"You don't look so good today,"
said a short, ample woman who's been coming to the kitchen for the past year or two. I know her name is Laura, and that she was born in Detroit and has 2 grown sons. She used to work as a housekeeper on M Street in Georgetown, but the family felt she'd gotten too old for the job and let her go with only a couple weeks' severance and warm words of appreciation.
"You deserve better. You deserve me,"
Laura said, and laughed mischievously.
"What do you say?"
"Laura, you're too kind with your compliments," I said, dishing up her usual extra dish. "Anyway, you've met Christine. You know I'm already spoken for." Laura giggled as she hugged herself with both arms. She had a fine, healthy laugh, even under the circumstances.
"A young girl has to dream, you know. Nice to see you, as always."
"Same to you, Laura. As always, nice to see you. Enjoy the meal."
"Oh, I do. You can see I do."
As I said my cheery hellos and dished out heaped portions of peanut butter, I allowed myself to think about Christine.
Laura was probably right. Maybe I didn't look so good today. I probably hadn't looked too terrific for a few days. I still remember tonight about 2 weeks back. I had just finished working a multiple homicide case in Boston. Christine and I stood on the porch in front of her house out in Mitchellville. I was trying to live my life differently, but it's hard to change. I had a saying I really liked. Heart leads head. I could smell the flowers in the night air, roses and impatiens growing in profusion. I could also smell gardenia passion, a favorite perfume that Christine was wearing that night. She and I had known each other for a year and a half. We'd met during a murder investigation that had ended with the death of her husband. Eventually, we began to go out. I was thinking that it had all been leading to this moment on the porch. At least, it had been in my mind. I had never seen Christine when she didn't look good to me and make me feel lightheaded. She's tall, almost 5'10", and that's nice. She had a smile that could probably light up half the country. That night, she was wearing tight, faded jeans and a white T-shirt knotted around her waist. Her feet were bare and her nails were dabbed with red polish. Her beautiful brown eyes were shining. I reached out and took her into my arms, and suddenly everything seemed right with the world. I forgot all about the terrible case I'd just finished. I forgot about the particularly vicious killer known as Mr. Smith. I cupped her sweet, kind face gently in my hands. I like to think that nothing scares me anymore, and many things don't. But I guess the more good things you have in your life, the easier it is to experience fear. Christine felt so precious to me, so maybe I was scared. Heart leads head. It isn't the way most men act, but I was learning. I love you more than I've ever loved anything in my life, Christine. You help me see and feel things in new ways. I love your smile, your way with people, especially kids, your kindness. I love to hold you like this. I love you more than I could say if I stood here and talked for the rest of the night. I love you so much. Will you marry me, Christine? She didn't answer right away. I felt her pull back, just a little, and my heart caught. I looked into her eyes, and what I saw was pain and uncertainty. It nearly broke my heart. "Oh, Alex, Alex," she whispered, and looked as if she might cry. "I can't give you an answer. You just came back from Boston. You were on another horrible, horrible murder case. I can't take that. Your life was in danger again. That terrible madman was in your house. He threatened your family. You can't deny any of that." I couldn't. It had been a terrifying experience, and I had nearly died. "I won't deny anything you said, but I do love you. I can't deny that either. I'll quit the police force if that's what it takes."
"No."
A softness came into her eyes. She shook her head back and forth.
"That would be all wrong, for both of us."
We held each other on the porch, and I knew we were in trouble. I didn't know how to resolve it. I had no idea. Maybe if I left the force, became a full-time therapist again, led a more normal life for Christine and the kids. But could I do that? Could I really quit?
"Ask me again," she whispered. "Ask me again sometime."
Chapter 8. Christine and I had dated since that night, and it just felt right, easy, comfortable, and romantic. It always was that way between us. Still, I wondered if our problem could be fixed. Could she be happy with a homicide detective? Could I stop being one? I didn't know. I was brought out of my reverie about Christine by the high-pitched, stuttering wail of a siren out on 12th Street, just turning off E.
I winced when I saw Samson's black Nissan pull up in front of St. Anthony's. He turned off the siren on his rooftop, but then beeped the car horn, sat on it. I knew he was here for me, probably to take me somewhere I didn't want to go. The horn continued to blare.
"It's your friend John Samson," Jimmy Moore called out. "You hear him, Alex?"
"I know who it is," I called back to Jimmy. "I'm hoping that he goes away."
"Sure doesn't sound like it."
I finally walked outside, crossing through the soup kitchen line, and receiving a few jokey jeers. People I had known for a long time accused me of working half a day, or said that if I didn't like the job, could they have it?
"What's up?"
I called to Samson before I got all the way out to his black sports car. Samson's side window came sliding down. I leaned inside the car.
"You forget? It's my day off," I reminded him.
"It's Nina Childs," Samson said in the low, soft voice he used only when he was angry or very serious.
He was trying to deaden his facial muscles, to look tough, not emotional. But it wasn't working real well.
"Nina's dead, Alex."
I shivered involuntarily. I opened the car door and got in. I didn't even go back to the kitchen to tell Jimmy Moore I was leaving. Samson jerked the car away from the curbside fast. The siren came on again, but now I almost welcomed the mournful wail. It numbed me.
"What do you know so far?" I asked as we rushed along the intensely bleak streets of Southeast, then crossed the slate-gray Anacostia River.
"She was dumped in a row house, 18th and Garnsville. Jerome Thurman is out there with her. Says she's probably been dead there since the weekend. Some needle pusher found the body." "No clothes or ID, Alex," Samson said.
I looked over at him.
"So how did they know it was Nina?" "Uniform guy on the scene recognized her. Knew her from the hospital. Everybody knew Nina."
I shut my eyes, but I saw Nina Child's face, and I opened them again. She'd been the 11-7 charge nurse in the ER unit at St. Anthony's Hospital, where once I'd run like a tornado with a dying little boy in my arms. Samson and I had worked with Nina more times than I could remember. Samson had also dated Nina for over a year, but then they'd broken it off. She'd married a neighborhood man who worked for the city. They had two kids, two little babies. And Nina had seemed so happy the last time I saw her. I couldn't believe she was lying dead in a tenement cellar on the wrong side of the Anacostia. She had been abandoned, like one of the Jane Does.
Chapter 9.
Nina Childs's body had been found in a battered row house in one of the city's most impoverished, destroyed, and dismaying neighborhoods. There was only one patrol car on the scene and a single rusted and dented EMS van. Homicides in Southeast don't attract much attention. A dog was barking somewhere, and it was the only sound on the desolate street. Samson and I had to walk past an open-air drug mart on the corner of 18th Street. Mostly young males, but a few children and two women were also gathered there defiantly. The drug marts are everywhere in this part of Southeast. The neighborhood youth activity is the crack trade.
"Daily body pickup, officers?"
said one of the young men. He was wearing black trousers with black suspenders, no shirt, socks, or shoes. He had a prison yard physique and tattoos everywhere.
"Come to take out the trash,"
an older man cackled from behind an unruly patch of salt-and-pepper beard.
"Take that motherfucking barking all-night dog while you're here. Make yourselves useful," he added.
Samson and I ignored them and continued walking across 18th, then into the boarded-up, three-storied row house straight ahead. A black-and-white boxer leaned out of a third-floor window, like a lifetime resident, and wouldn't stop barking. Otherwise, the building appeared deserted. The front door had been jimmied 100 times, so it just swung open for us. The building smelled of fire, garbage, water damage. There was a gaping hole in the ceiling from a burst steam pipe. It was so wrong for Nina to have ended up in this sad, abominable place. For over a year, I had been unofficially investigating unsolved murders in Southeast, many of them Jane Doe's. My count was well over 100, but no one else in the department was willing to agree to that number, or anything close to it.
Several of the murdered women were drug abusers or prostitutes, but not Nina. We carefully descended a circular stairwell that had a shaky, well-worn wooden railing that neither of us would touch. I could see flashlights shining up ahead, and I already had my mag light turned on. Nina was deep in the basement of the abandoned building. At least somebody had bothered to tape off the perimeter to protect the crime scene. I saw Nina's body, and I had to look away. It wasn't just that she was dead. It was how she'd been killed. I tried to put my mind and eyes somewhere else until I regained some composure. Jerome Thurman was there with the EMS team. So was a single patrol officer, probably the one who had identified Nina. No ME was present. It wasn't unusual for the medical examiner not to show up for homicides in Southeast. There were dead flowers on the floor near the body. I focused on the flowers, still not able to look at Nina again. It didn't fit with the other Jane Does, but the killer didn't have a strict pattern. That was one of the problems I was having. It might mean that his fantasy was still evolving, and that he hadn't finished making up his gruesome story yet. I noted shreds of foil and cellophane wrappers lying everywhere on the floor. Rats are attracted to shiny things and often bring them back to their nests. Thick cobwebs weaved from one end of the basement to the other. I had to look at Nina again. I needed to look closely. "I'm Detective Alex Cross. Let me take a look at her, please," I finally said to the EMS team, a man and a woman in their 20s. "I'll just be a couple of minutes, then I'll get out of your way." "The other detectives already released the body," the male EMS worker said. He was rail thin with long, dirty blonde hair. He didn't bother to look up at me. "Let us finish our job and get the hell out of this cesspool. Whole area is highly infectious. Smells like shit."
"Just back away," Samson barked. "Get up before I pull your skinny ass up."
The MS techie cursed, but he stood and backed away from Nina's body. I moved in close, tried to concentrate and be professional, tried to remember specific details I had gathered about the previous Jane Does in Southeast. I was looking for some connection. I wondered if a single predator could possibly be killing so many people. If that was the case, then this would be one of the most savage killing sprees ever. I took a deep breath, and then I knelt over Nina. The rats had been at her, I could see, but the killer had done much worse damage. It looked to me as if Nina had been beaten to death, with punches and possibly kicks. She might have been struck 100 times or more. I had rarely seen anyone given this much punishment. Why did it have to happen? She was only 31 years old, a mother of 2, kind, talented, dedicated to her work at St. Anthony's. There was a sudden noise, like a rifle shot in the building. It reverberated right through the basement walls. The EMS workers jumped. The rest of us laughed nervously. I knew exactly what the sound was. "Just rat traps," I said to the EMS team. "Get used to it." Chapter 10. I was at the homicide scene for a little over 2 hours, much longer than I wanted to be there, and I hated every second. I couldn't fix a set pattern for the Jane Doe killings, and Nina Child's murder didn't help. Why had he struck her so many times and so savagely? What were the flowers doing there? Could this be the work of the same killer? The way I usually operate at a crime scene is to let the homicide investigation take on an almost aerial view. Everything emanates from the body. Samson and I walked the entire crime scene, from the basement to each floor and on up to the roof. Then we walked the neighborhood. Nobody had seen anything unusual, which didn't surprise either of us. Now came the really bad part. Samson and I drove from the Woeful Tenement to Nina's apartment in the Brookland section of Washington, east of Catholic University. I knew I was being sucked in again, but there was nothing I could do about it. It was a sweltering hot day, and the sun hammered Washington without mercy. We were both silent and withdrawn during the ride. What we had to do was the worst thing about our job, telling a family about the death of a loved one. I didn't know how I could do it this time. Nina's building was a well-kept brown-brick apartment house on Monroe Street. Miniature yellow roses were blooming out front in bright green window boxes. It didn't look as if anything bad should happen to someone who lived here. Everything about the place was so bright and hopeful, just as Nina had been. I was becoming more and more disturbed and upset about the brutal and obscene murder, and about the fact that it probably wouldn't get a decent investigation from the department, at least not officially. Nana Mama would chalk it up to her conspiracy theories about the white overlords and their criminal disinterest in the people of Southeast. She had often told me that she felt morally superior to white people, that she would never, ever treat them the way they treated the black people of Washington.
Nina's sister Marie takes care of the kids, Samson said as we rode down Monroe. She's a nice girl. Had a drug problem one time. Beat it. Nina helped her. The whole family is close-knit. A lot like yours. This is going to be real bad, Alex.
I turned to him. Not surprisingly, he was taking Nina's death even harder than I was. It's unusual for him to show his emotions, though. I can do it, John. You stay here in the car. I'll go up and talk to the family. Samson shook his head and sighed loudly.
Doesn't work that way, sugar.
He snugged the Nissan up to the curb and we both climbed out. He didn't stop me from coming along to the apartment, so I knew he wanted me there with him. He was right. This was going to be bad. The child's apartment took up the first and second floors. The front door was slightly ornate, aluminum. Nina's husband was already at the door. He had on the proletariat uniform of the D.C. Housing Authority, where he worked. Mud-stained work boots, blue trousers, a shirt marked DCHA. One of the babies snuggled in his arms, a beautiful girl who looked at me and smiled and cooed.
"Could we come inside for a moment?" Samson asked.
"It's Nina,"
the husband said, and started to break down right there in the doorway.
"I'm sorry, William," I spoke softly.
"You're right. She's gone. She was found this morning."
William Childs started to sob loudly. He was a powerful-looking working man, but that didn't matter. He held his bewildered little girl to his chest and tried to control the crying, but he couldn't.
"Oh, God, no. Oh, Nina. Nina, baby. How could somebody kill her? How could anybody do that? Oh, Nina. Nina. Nina."
A young, pretty woman came up behind him. She had to be Nina's sister, Marie. She took the baby from her sister's husband, and the little girl began to scream as if she knew what had happened. I had seen so many families, so many good people who had lost loved ones on these merciless streets. I knew it would never completely stop, but I felt it ought to get better. It never did. The sister motioned for us to come inside, and I noticed a whole table on which there were two pocketbooks, as if Nina were still about. The apartment was comfortable-looking and neat, with light bamboo and white cushioned furniture. The whir of a window air conditioner was constant. A Yadro porcelain figure of a nurse stood on an end table. I was still sorting through details of the homicide scene, trying to connect the murder to the other Jane Does. We learned that Nina had attended a healthcare charity dinner on Saturday night. William had been working overtime. The family called the police late Saturday night. Two detectives had shown up, but no one had been able to find Nina until now. Then I was holding the baby while Nina's sister took the chill off a bottle of formula. It was such a sad and poignant moment, knowing this poor little girl would never see her mother again, never know how truly special her mother had been. It reminded me of my own kids and their mother, and of Christine, who was afraid I would die during some murder investigation like this one. The older little girl came up to me while I was holding her baby sister. She was 2 or 3 at the most.
"I got a new hairstyle,"
she said proudly, and did a half turn to show me.
"You did? It's beautiful. Who did those braids for you?"
"My mommy,"
said the girl. It was an hour later when Samson and I finally left the house. We drove away in silence and despair, the same way we'd come. After a couple of blocks, Samson pulled over in front of a ramshackle neighborhood bodega covered with beer and soda posters. He gave a deep sigh, put his hands to his face, and then cried. I'd never, ever seen John like this before. Not in all the years we'd been friends, not even when we were just boys. I reached out and laid a hand on his shoulder, and he didn't move away. Then he told me something he hadn't shared before. I loved her, Alex, but I let her get away. I never told her how I felt. We have to get this son of a bitch.
Chapter 11.
I sensed I was at the start of another homicide mess. I didn't want it, but I couldn't stop the horror. I had to try to do something about the Jane Does. I couldn't just stand by and do nothing. Although I was assigned to the 7th District as a senior detective, my job as liaison with the FBI gave me some extra status, and also the freedom to occasionally work without too much supervision or interference. My mind was running free, and had already made some associations between Nina's murder and at least some of the unsolved killings. First, there had been no identification on the victims at each crime scene. Second, the bodies had frequently been dumped in buildings where they might not be found quickly. Third, not a single witness had seen anyone who might be a suspect. The most we ever got was that there had been traffic or people out on the streets where one of the bodies had been found. That told me that the killer knew how to blend in, and that he possibly was a black man. Around 6 that night, I finally headed home. This was supposed to be my day off. I had things to do there, and I was trying to balance the demands of job and home life as best I could. I put on a happy face and headed inside the house. Damon, Janny, and Nana were singing, "Sit down, you're rockin' the boat," in the kitchen. The show tune was music to my ears and other essential parts of my anatomy. The kids looked happy as could be. There is a lot to be said for the innocence of childhood. I heard Nana say, "How bad I can tell the world." Then the three of them launched into one of the most beautiful spirituals I know. Damon's voice seemed particularly strong to me. I hadn't really noticed that before. "I feel like I just walked into a story by Louisa May Alcott," I said, laughing for the first time that long day.
"I take that as a high compliment," Nana said.
She was somewhere between her late 70s and early 80s now, but not telling, and also not showing, her age.
"Who's Louise Mays Alcott?"
Janny said, and made a lemon-sucking face. "She is a healthy little skeptic, although almost never a cynic. In that way, she takes after both her father and her grandmother. Look it up tonight, little one. 50 cents in your pocket for the correct answer," I told her.
"You're on,"
Janny grinned.
"You can pay me right now if you like." "Me too?"
Damon asked. "Of course. You can look up Jane Austen," I said to him. "Now what's with the heavenly harmonizing? I like it very much, by the way. I just want to know what the special occasion is."
"We're just singing while we prepare supper,"
Nana said, and stuck up her nose and twinkled her eyes.
"You play jazz and the blues on the piano, don't you? We harmonize like angels sometimes. No special reason necessary. Good for the soul and the soul food, I suppose. Can't hurt."
"Well, don't stop singing on my account," I said. But they had already stopped. Too bad. Something was going on. I figured out that much. A musical mystery to be solved in my own house. "We still on for boxing after dinner?" I asked cautiously. I was feeling a little vulnerable because I didn't want them to turn me down for the boxing lesson that had become a ritual.
"Of course,"
Damon said, and frowned like I must be out of my mind to even ask such a question.
"Of course, pshaw. Why wouldn't we?"
Janny said, and brushed off my silly question with a wave of her hand.
"How's Miss Johnson?"
she asked then.
"You two talk today?"
"I still want to know what the singing was all about," I answered Janny with a question of my own.
"You have valuable information? Well, so do I. Tit for tat," she said. "How do you like that?"
A little later, I decided to call Christine at home. Lately, it had seemed more like the way it had been between us before I got involved with the Mr. Smith case. We talked for a while, and then I asked her to go out on Friday.
"Of course. I'd like that, Alex. What should I wear?" she asked.
I hesitated. "Well, I always like what you choose, but wear something special." She didn't ask why. Chapter 12. After one of Nana's roast chicken dinners with baked sweet potatoes and homemade bread, I took the kids downstairs for their weekly boxing lesson. Following the Tuesday night fight with the kids, I glanced at my watch and saw that it was already a little past 9. The doorbell rang a moment later. I set down a terrific book called The Color of Water and pushed myself up from my chair in the family room. "I'll get it. It's probably for me," I called out.
"Maybe it's Christine. You never know," Janny teased, then darted away into the kitchen.
Both of the kids adored Christine, in spite of the fact that she was the principal at their school. I knew exactly who was out on the porch. I'd been expecting 4 homicide detectives from the First District: Jerome Thurman, Rakeem Powell, Sean Moore, and Samson. 3 of the detectives were standing out on the porch. Rosie the Cat and I let them inside. Samson arrived about 5 minutes later, and we all gathered in the backyard. What we were doing at the house wasn't illegal, but it wouldn't make us a lot of friends in high places in the police department. We sat on lawn chairs, and I set out beer and low-fat pretzels that 270-pound Jerome scoffed at.
"Beer and low-fat pretzels? Give me a break, Alex. You lost your mind? Hey, you having an affair with my wife? You must have got this bad idea from Claudette."
"I bought these especially for you, big man. I'm trying to give your heart a break," I told him, and the others guffawed loudly. We all pick on Jerome.
This book is continued on Disc 2.